Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is recovering from a voice treatment and she'll be back on Monday. North Korea admits to a failed rocket launch. The United States transfers control of night raids to Afghanistan, and a political scandal hits China over the alleged murder of a British businessman. Joining us for the international hour of our Friday News Roundup, James Kitfield of National Journal, Nadia Bilbasi of NBC TV, the Middle East Broadcast Center, and Mark Landler of The New York Times. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning, Susan.
Our listeners can call us shortly. Our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Well, just extraordinary, Mark Landler, what's coming out of North Korea. They had the rocket launch that we've been watching for, but it did not go well. What happened?
Well, as you say, really an extraordinary turn of events. After weeks of buildup, an international media flotilla that had been gathered by the North Koreans to witness this triumphant event, the rocket, which was carrying a satellite, broke up well before it reached orbit, only a minute or so after it had been launched, and fell harmlessly into the sea, amounting to a huge embarrassment for the new leader, the new young leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un. What makes this particularly painful for him and perhaps for his stature in the country is that the launch was part of a week of festivities leading up to the 100th anniversary of the birth of his grandfather, Kim Il-sung, who's revered as the father of the North Korean nation. And this was meant to showcase, indeed, North Korea's technological prowess and be a tribute to him. So the fact that the rocket broke up in this ignominious way is just an enormous embarrassment for North Korea. And it raises some interesting questions, one of which is whether the North Koreans will now feel even more compelled than they did before to proceed with even more provocative acts. There's already an expectation that they're building toward a nuclear test, and they may want to accelerate those plans, if only to try to save face on behalf of the young Kim.
Nadia.
But also there is a sigh of relief from the international community, the United States, Japan, and South Korea, that actually it failed, and it failed miserably, because the options for them, if it succeeded, what they're going to do? And the options for the United States are very limited. If they're going to go to the Security Council, the maximum they can do is a weak statement, because they'd want to use their political capital with China and with Russia, with other important issues as well, with Iran and Syria. So in a way, that what we have seen yesterday, that everybody expected that they're going to launch it anyway, because it was a matter of time, of a window of opportunity of 24 hours that they're going to do it. It shows as well that from so many experts who are talking about North Korea, that maybe they are really further away from technology than the West believed, that maybe they're a decade away from developing anything. Now, the North Koreans always said and insisted that they're using this rocket to launch a satellite into orbit. The West is saying basically this is an excuse and a disguise, basically, because they're testing a long-term missiles that ultimately will reach the United States, Alaska or Ohio, maybe, Alaska or Hawaii. And basically, a matter of time before they can put a nuclear head on it. So the failure maybe is good for everybody. It saves the day and let the international community focus on another crisis.
James.
I'm going to draw a slightly more pessimistic view of this, and that is that, as my colleague said, they'll almost certainly feel the need to do something else to save face here, because the whole thing was wrapped around trying to make the young kid look like, you know, the great leader. And in recent years, provocative actions have included sinking a South Korean ship with a great loss of life, shelling a South Korean island, also with loss of life, and, as he mentioned, a nuclear weapon. So I think we're in for a relatively unstable period looking with North Korea. And there's another interesting aspect of this, which is the Obama administration had a policy of basically not getting caught up with all these little side deals with North Korea, which it always, it's like Lucy pulling the football away, constantly goes back on them. They've been a pretty good job of sort of making North Korea feel ignored, and that's probably a good thing, to have it feel ignored. In this case, they reached a deal in February to trade a lot of food aid for a cessation of uranium enrichment. And no sooner was that deal reached than North Korea just, you know, blithely sort of ignores it. So it shows that the original idea the Obama administration had of not getting caught up in this tit for tat with North Korea was probably wise.
You know, Mark, it was interesting. There was the Mitt Romney, the now the presumptive Republican nominee for president against President Obama, almost instantly sent out a press release criticizing the Obama administration for what North Korea had done with this launch and calling its policy incompetent. What did you make of that?
Well, Mitt Romney hasn't lost a chance yet to take aim at the Obama administration on foreign policy, and he used the word appeasement, which was not surprising in a way because it did follow on the heels of this attempt to reopen a diplomatic channel to Pyongyang. But, you know, the administration's counterargument, they'd offer two. One, they'd say that Mitt Romney has no stature to make that kind of charge. And indeed, the administration has become increasingly indignant at his second-guessing of their foreign policy, whether it's the Russians and missile defense, whether it's withdrawing from Iraq, which he called a spectacularly inept move, and which has actually come off reasonably smoothly. But in this case, they'll simply make the argument that unlike the Bush administration, or for that matter, the Clinton administration, we didn't actually give the food to the North Koreans before they reneged on the deal. So their argument is we haven't fallen into the trap of our predecessors, which was marked by giving them either fuel or technology only to have them renege on whatever deal they had made. So that'll be their counterargument. Both sides have something they can claim. And for Mitt Romney, it does point out that President Obama, despite his record of successes in counterterrorism, in winding down the Iraq war, foreign policy continues to be an area that could present a vulnerability for him.
James, I wonder, there's a domestic political side to this, but in dealing with a rogue regime like that in North Korea, does it matter when they hear this kind of debate in this country?
I don't think they pay much attention. They have their own. I mean, especially North Korea, which is the hermit kingdom called the hermit kingdom for a reason. They're not really plugged into our domestic politics too well, and I don't think he's surrounded by a bunch of American political experts. I will say that I think that this tit for tat we're hearing from on our side in our politics is something that that's exactly right. We're going to be hearing that on virtually every issue. Every issue we talk to today, there'll be criticism aimed at the Obama administration. I don't know how seriously you can take that. It's a political season.
Let's talk about Syria. We've had this UN negotiated truce, Nadia. How is it going?
Well, so far it's a success for Kofi Annan, but we have to be very cautious about it. Today, the Security Council in the process of debating, and they might issue a statement basically enforcing Kofi Annan's six-point plan. The ceasefire is holding, but it's very fragile. So holding meaning that we're not saying 100 people dying every day. We're saying maybe 10 or 12 or 32, but that's still big enough for a human life. But on the other hand, I think we have to contribute some of the success to Russia and China. I think the fact that they pushed Kofi Annan plan is showing that the Russians in particular are changing their position. Now, the plan also have political fold into it. It's not just the basically cessation of hostilities, although it's not completely full in terms of the army not withdrawing from major towns and major cities. And the army are stopping people today, for example, from going conversion into Damascus or Aleppo major cities, because the test for this government is once, and let's remember that when the uprising started 13 months ago, the idea was we saw people in the streets demonstrating peacefully. Now that the Kofi Annan is calling for this very precise point, will the regime tolerate people going into the streets and protesting peacefully? And this is what we're going to see is happening or not. Just one point regarding the observers or the monitoring team. Kofi Annan's spokesperson, Ahmed Fawzi, just said in Geneva that they have already 11 people ready to go on a plane now to Damascus. The UN is talking about 30, I think, but 30 is still very little. It's still early, and I think considering what we have seen in other places like Kosovo, when you have like thousands of people, talking about 50 or 200, it's very little in Syria now. But at least I think there is some sign that this is the last chance for diplomacy for President Assad. I think the pressure is mounting on him from his allies, and we've seen that in Kofi Annan's trip to Tehran and to Russia and to China.
James.
I was just going to reiterate that I think this is probably the first good news we've heard out of Syria for quite a while. I mean, even though it is an extremely fragile ceasefire, it's the first time we've seen actually both sides kind of stand back a little bit. And that's exactly right. The next steps will be the critical ones. Do they allow humanitarian aid into the stricken cities? Do they allow the UN monitors? Do they allow the journalists that they promised? And this deal is a six-part deal and allow peaceful protests. You know, it's hard for a lot of us who've watched Assad in the last year to believe he's going to comply with all those things. And if he doesn't comply, this thing could unravel pretty quickly.
Mark.
President Sarkozy said yesterday that he believes that Assad is not being sincere and expressed a lot of skepticism about this. And it is worth noting that the Arab League had sent representatives into Syria weeks ago and withdrew them in frustration because they weren't getting the kind of access they needed. So while I certainly don't dispute that it's a good sign that there is a fragile ceasefire, I think this is more in the manner of Assad having bought himself some time as opposed to any sense of a resolution to the situation. And you know, it's worth noting that Secretary Clinton yesterday reiterated the American position, which is that Assad must go. That's not yet the Russian position. And so the Russians, seeing where they go and whether they slowly inch toward that position, is in some ways the really important story now.
So do you think Assad survives, James?
I've never thought that he could survive long term after this. I think it's impossible to imagine him as sort of a normal head of state again.
Yeah. What do you think, Nadia?
I don't think he will survive. I think he's running out of time. The problem for him now is how can he find a negotiated settlement? Maybe he can leave the country somehow peacefully without being harmed.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go to the phones. Our phone lines are open, 1-800-433-8850. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And for the international hour of our Friday News Roundup, I'm joined by Mark Landler, White House correspondent for The New York Times. Nadia Bilbasi, she's senior U.S. correspondent for the Middle East Broadcast Center. And James Kitfield, he's senior correspondent for National Journal. We're going to go to the phones in just a moment. We were talking, though, before the break about the situation in Syria. And Mark, you noted that Secretary of State Clinton said just yesterday that President Assad has to go. How fast does the U.S. want him to go?
Well, you know, the question in all of these cases is how does the leader go? And the U.S. is concerned that an abrupt or chaotic ouster could open the door to a civil war in Syria. Indeed, you could argue there's been the outlines of that already. And given the, you know, relative weakness of or relative lack of organization of the opposition in Syria – as compared, for example, to Egypt. I think the U.S. is somewhat concerned about doing this in a way that it is a process, not a sudden chaotic event. And a negotiated settlement as opposed to a violent ouster.
And also, they're still suspicious of the opposition. They wanted to have more time to find out who they are. Are they able really to take over the day after Bashar al-Assad falls out? And also, we know that there is no military solution. So for them, the options are really limited, although they have been calling for him to leave and they said he lost legitimacy, but they never come up with a plan. So they were happy to see Annan being outsourcing the Syria to somebody else like the UN, basically, and they cannot operate outside the Security Council without the Russian and the Chinese.
So, James, is the opposition ready to take over?
No. It's funny, we keep saying we don't know who these guys are, but we're meeting with them constantly. The problem is when we meet with them, we don't like what we see. They're fractured. They have, you have the group that's outside of Syria and has been for quite a while, the group inside Syria. The rebellion itself is fractured. You have the Free Syrian Army, former defectors from the army. You have just, regular kind of insurgents. The whole thing smells a lot like a civil war, and my colleagues are right. That's the thing that scares everyone most. The thing about Assad, though, is the status quo is looking more and more like a civil war. So they're looking for the next step. And if it's peaceful protests that convince them to leave, they'll be happy with that.
We've had lots of news this week on those night raids in Afghanistan. First, we had an agreement reached between the United States and the Afghanistan government about turning over more control of these operations, Mark, to the Afghan forces. Is that significant?
It is significant because the night raids were one of the real flashpoints between the U.S. and the Afghans in this, very difficult, tormented handover of security from NATO and the U.S. to the Afghans. So it was something Karzai pushed very hard for. In practice, some of it was already happening. For months, these raids have been conducted by joint groups of Afghan security forces and U.S. So it is an important development. It may go some way toward clearing the air between these two sides and what's always been a tortured relationship. But it points out another sort of fact that just every day becomes more and more clear, which is that the NATO and the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan is accelerating, is quickening. The U.S. is turning the page on this war, maybe faster even than people expected. And this is one more example of that.
It's a contentious issue for the Afghanis because of cultural sensibilities and because of sovereignty issues. You know, this night raids is being always seen as the U.S. Special Forces operating by themselves outside the law. And some even think that the recent massacres of 17 civilians was a result of these raids. Now, the Pentagon is saying that this is not giving sovereignty or not giving a veto power to the Afghan forces, that in fact they're going to sit down and they're going to agree on when they're going to conduct him. And also the U.S. military are saying that they have a bad name, these night raids, because in the last year they conducted 2,200 of them and only 90% of them were nonviolent. And actually 1.3% only were casualties, civilian casualties. I mean, still big enough. One civilian dying is bad enough. But they're saying basically that this is a good step and it will help ultimately in the handover. But it doesn't mean still that the U.S. will follow what the tribal leaders in certain areas will tell them. And I think this agreement will clear the way for this strategic partnership that we're going to see in Chicago in the NATO summit. So step in the right direction, clearing the air, misunderstanding here and there. And it's good to consolidate this kind of understanding between the Afghanis and the U.S.
James?
There's a lot of unanswered questions about this deal, and believe me, there's a lot of people in Congress who want those questions answered, because basically the reason for us being there beyond 2014 is so we can make sure that al-Qaeda and other extremist groups don't find home in Afghanistan in the future. The primary tool we use to do that are these night raids where you kill or capture these guys. If we're not allowed to do that under this deal, we need a warrant from an Afghan court, and the Afghans, from my reading of it, actually have the final saying it. So if that's the case, are you still going to be effective in your counterterrorism operations? If you're not, the support in the American Congress for maintaining a major presence in Afghanistan post-2014 and to keep spending billions of dollars and funding the Afghan security forces is going to be in jeopardy.
Do you think it creates problems for the U.S. military now in continuing to do what they want to do in Afghanistan?
Sure. I mean, they are. They're extremely unpopular, much like the drone strikes are extremely unpopular in Pakistan. But they've become, you know, the primary counterterrorism tool for the U.S. military. So they want to find if this agreement is such that you can still be effective, yet have an Afghan lead and an Afghan face on it, all to the good. But it's just not clear. The American generals have said pretty strongly in the past they've resisted this for the very reason they worry they won't be effective.
You know, Mark, you mentioned you raised the issue of whether our withdrawal from Afghanistan is actually going to move faster than it had been originally intended. And we know that that Afghan President Hamid Karzai said he might call early elections. Could that contribute to accelerating this process?
Yes. I mean, I think it's all bound up in the same issue. I think Karzai probably wouldn't have publicly broached the idea of early elections unless he felt that the transition was picking up pace. I mean, as with the night raids deal, though, there's a lot of questions about what Karzai said about early elections. I mean, for one thing, some of the opposition don't even favor having early elections. There's a big question about whether you do early elections at a time when there's still a presence of NATO in the coalition or whether you do them only after NATO and the coalition are gone. And there are sort of mixed feelings about that in the country. I mean, I have to say, having written about things that Hamid Karzai has said over the past 3 or 4 years, I'm not convinced we won't be hearing, a rather different story from him a month from now.
Yeah, actually, in fact, he said he did not discuss this idea seriously, and his aides said that it might take a long time before they take this decision. And also, I think, according to the Constitution, the president has to step down or to die before they can actually call for a new election. But I think also the former British ambassador to Kabul said recently that there is talk about it, but he has not seen it being discussed seriously. But if they do discuss it, this is a good idea, because imagine that the NATO forces are leaving Afghanistan, that this objective has been left to the security forces to be in charge of the country. And on top of that, you have an election. So in principle, I think it's a good idea if he steps down. And also after 10 years, he's been the face of Afghanistan for ever since the invasion in early 2002. And he's not very popular. There's corruption charges against him. He has not contributed to improving the life of daily Afghanis. So maybe a new generation will be good to come, a new leaders. But as Mark said, I don't also we have to wait and see. Maybe he will change his mind. I think he wanted to still have that final year before he actually officially cannot run, because the Constitution bar him from running for a third term.
James.
No one looks more forward to the post-Karzai era than I do in Afghanistan. I mean, he's been everything Mark said and more in terms of his unreliability of what he says. But this is a very serious issue. Right now, the timing is really bad. We're going to have an election in 2014 for the next leader, and there aren't any really shining examples of people who, you know, would step into that with all the ethnic divisions they have in that country. And at the same time, we're going to be pulling the vast majority of NATO troops out. It's a bad combination. It'd much be better if you had an election in 2013 while you still had a sizable presence of NATO forces to really secure the polling places, etc. So it's a serious issue.
We had learned just this morning that Pakistan has given the United States a list of demands, including the end of drone strikes. And one reason this is causing, you know, people are paying a lot of attention to this is because both the government and opposition joined in presenting these demands. Mark, what do you make of that?
Well, you know, the U.S. has said several times and again in the past few days that they really support the effort of the parliament to kind of do a major review of the U.S.-Pakistani relationship, which has been, by, you know, all accounts, a dreadful relationship full of suspicion and mutual mistrust. And the drone strikes are a key part of that. It raises, of course, the same issues that the night raids deal raises in Afghanistan, which is that drone strikes are the way most American counterterrorism is carried out in Pakistan. So putting strict limits on how drone strikes can be authorized and carried out raises questions for the United States. I mean, it's also worth noting that, it was, in fact, the government and the opposition that are bringing this proposal to the United States. I'd be interested in where the military is in all this, because the military is really the important player at a time when the civilian government is as weak as it is. So, again, a lot of unanswered questions.
I think that's right as well. And you know, some questions I have is, you know, if you stop the drone strikes, would the Pakistani government and military be willing to then contest some of these sanctuaries? If not, then you've just ceded. You're pulling your troops out at a time when you've ceded to the Taliban insurgency absolute sanctuary with no, you know, no reason to look over their shoulder. That could be a very dicey thing for the future of Afghanistan and whether it goes into a civil war. So I have some questions here. I think it's kind of an opening gambit, if you will. That's their sort of the sense of the government, opposition, and the ruling party, that these things must stop. They've had that position for quite a long time. But they haven't been willing to give us what we need to stop those.
I think both the political and military leadership in Pakistan wanted to have good relationship in the U.S. for their both interests of the countries. And it's like a really bad marriage, but both sides know they have to stay because the way out is even worse. So I think the fact that the Pakistanis has suspended this route that NATO used, the supply routes to come in after the U.S. Hit and killed 24 Pakistani soldiers, as a result, they blocked these supply routes. Now they wanted to reopen it. So they cannot reopen it without given anything in return. So they're asking for concession from the United States to show to their people, because this drones attack has been very, very unpopular in Pakistan. So basically they're saying, okay, we get in from the Americans this concession of stopping the drone attacks, although they have demanded this before in, I think, 2008, and it didn't never stopped. So in principle, they will open this, and they say, and they add the caveat, which is basically you don't transport military equipment, which has been the case anyway, but only use it for supply of food and for fuel.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to go to the phones now and take your calls. Our phone lines are open, 1-800-433-8850. Give us a call. Let's start with Jack. He's calling us from Chantilly, Virginia. Jack, hi. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. My comment and question is about the North Korean missile launch. I'm surprised that the idea that that failure of that launch was not caused by some other agency, perhaps one of ours, has not come up. I mean, isn't it certainly possible that we had something to do with that?
Jack, that's such a great question. We've gotten a number of emails along those lines. Here's one from Don, who says, do any of the panelists think the missile launched by North Korea could have been destroyed by a secret U.S. space defense? What do you think, Mark?
Well, you can't discount something like that, and the Japanese threatened to shoot a Patriot anti-missile missile at this missile if it looked like it was coming toward Japanese territory. So there was some talk in advance of disabling this missile. I mean, the honest answer is we don't know, and given how intelligence works, we may not know for a while, if ever. You know, there is an American argument, by the way, that they did contribute to the failure of this launch. And the argument is that the sanctions that are in place now, which prohibit North Korea from buying all sorts of dual-use technology, communications equipment that are used in guidance systems for satellites, that North Korea can't buy that material, and that as a result, its whole ballistic missile program is handicapped. And so that in a way, you could argue that the international community and the U.S. did play a role in hampering the ambitions of the North Koreans.
I actually think that's the most plausible argument here. This is like the third, I think, failed three-stage missile test that they've done. They've never pulled this off. It's a complicated thing to do, a lot more complicated than people think. It almost certainly wasn't shot down, because that kind of thing, you can detect it on radar, detected by all kinds of sensors that people pick up, and that leaks really fast. Was there some sort of a Stuxnet computer bug that we've inserted? There's no way to know that, but when you talk to U.S. officials, North Korea is a very hard nut to crack. It really is a prison country. Even Iran is much more open place than North Korea. I don't suspect that we have a lot of inside track on being able to sabotage their on the ground inside North Korea.
Mark, if what you say is true, that would be an example of a real success of a pretty nuanced policy.
It would indeed, and actually there's another argument that goes along with that, which is that, you know, every missile launch like this is also a chance for the North Koreans to showcase their wares in the international marketplace for this kind of stuff. North Korea has a record as a proliferator. So the fact that North Korea bungled this so spectacularly will also hurt its ability to sell technology or material In the past, there's been a channel to Syria. There was also talk in recent months before the political opening in Myanmar that the Burmese were a potential customer for North Korean technology. So the U.S. argument is maybe this really hurt them in that regard as well.
You know, Nadia, we also saw that, as James said, North Korea has failed in these attempts before, these tests. This time they told their own people that it had failed. How unusual is that?
Yeah, that's really interesting point, because when it was breaking news on almost every single international channel, apparently North Korean television was just showing irregular programs of, you know, praising Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung and etc., as if nothing happened. But and because also they, as Mark said earlier, they gathered all these international reporters to commemorate the celebration. So the fact that all of a sudden they declared that they have failed, that's really strange. I mean, I don't know what to make of it, why they came out and they acknowledged it, but I guess they have no option but to acknowledge it. Maybe because, as Mark alluded before, that they have something else. Some people already talk about nuclear testing somewhere, and maybe they're saying, okay, guys, this is a gimmick. You will see the real things we're going to do. I don't know, actually. I'm only speculating.
I'm only speculating, too. But what's interesting, that was the most surprising thing about the whole event. And I think that, you know, the huge question laying out there is this kid going to be any different from his father and his grandfather? This is the first sign that maybe there's cracks in that sort of hermit kingdom under him that'll be a slightly more transparent, but remains to be seen.
James Kitfield from National Journal. We're also talking this hour with Nadia Bilbasi of NBC TV and Mark Landler of The New York Times. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go back to the phones and take your calls and questions. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors mileage and safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. Learn more at progressive.com. By the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. And by the Pew Charitable Trusts, whose home visiting campaign works to advance policies to reduce child abuse and neglect, at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, in recognition of Poetry Month, we hear from poet Marie Howe. She's not very well known. The first poem of hers that caught our attention, What the Living Do, is about her new comprehension of life after her brother's death. Join us.
The Egyptian parliament passed a bill to forbid senior officials of the Mubarak regime from running for president. Nadia, who was that directed at?
Omar Suleiman, who was former head of the chief intelligence, and he was briefly vice president for President Mubarak. He's been associated with the regime that people today, actually, just before we came on air, there was thousands of Islamists in Tahrir Square, these images that we have seen during the revolution, basically demanding that this law should be respected, although it was passed by the parliament by the majority of the Islamists, but it has to be authorized by the military, basically. So this he's saying that we did not die, so we have somebody like Omar Suleiman taking over. So it aimed at him. It's also aimed at Ahmad Shafiq, who is also the former prime minister. And it might also disqualify Amr Musa. So the funniest thing is we have seen Yemen election with one candidate. We might see Egyptian elections with no candidates because everybody seems to be disqualified, including this guy Hazim Abu Ismail, who's a Salafist. Apparently his mother had an American passport. So they were saying, too, that we don't want him because, and the other two candidates, Ayman Noor is very well known in the West, the Liberal Party of Al-Ghad also was disqualified. And Khairat al-Shatir is qualified, was from the Muslim Brotherhood because he was jailed during the Mubarak regime.
Omar Suleiman said this week he was going to run. Why, James?
Well, the speculation is that the military council, and he was basically the right-hand man of General Mubarak, so the military council may want its own candidate in the race to watch out for its equities, which are manifest in that country's economy. So that's the speculation, that he was like a stalking horse for the generals in the military council. What's also interesting to me is there's this huge power struggle going on between the generals and the military council. Most of those are former Mubarak people. The new parliament, which is dominated by the Islamists, and the courts, which seem to be siding pretty much with the military council. The courts just threw out the constituent assembly for the time being because it was stacked with so many Islamists that the liberals and the secularists basically walked out. So they said, nope, start again. That can't be. So you see all these power centers in Cairo right now struggling with each other. And quite honestly, I mean, you're supposed to name a president by June. It's hard for you to see how all this plays out in any kind of an orderly way.
Well, is this good news because it's the tumult of democracy, or is it bad news because it's a sign of impending chaos?
It's both, actually. I mean, if we want to compare it to the dictatorship that we have seen in dominated the Arab worlds for decades, it's a good news that we have seen a parliamentary election that the majority Islamists won. Basically, they won fairly and squarely, as opposed to in the old days when they, stuffed the ballot boxes and basically the ruling party wins by 99.9. But I think, coming back to your earlier question, Omar Suleiman said that he wanted to run because he wanted to save Egypt, quote, from becoming a religious state, because we've seen in a consolidation of power of the Islamists, whether the Muslim Brotherhood or the Salafists. Between them, they have 70% of the votes and they will control everything in Egypt, the presidency, the parliament, Egypt's future, and he thinks Egypt is going to be isolated. So in a way, we've seen lots of chaos because the court are not really, they seems to be political, but because every time a candidate will be disqualified, the other candidate from the other party, the courts comes and says, well, his mother is American, he cannot run, they find something for him, etc. So the process is very messy, and democracy is a messy process, but there's some good signs there, but I think in the long run, we might have seen very unstable, a few years before things will settle down.
You know, there was an earlier Arab Spring in 2005 that Bush administration tried to engineer, and it collapsed because they pushed elections before democratic institutions. And when elections get out in front of democratic institutions, you can get some pretty extremist parties elected to rule, as happened with Hamas in the occupied territories. So, it seems to me like this is going very fast. They've done very little work on institution building, and that's why the secularists and the liberals walked out, because they weren't organized. The Muslim Brotherhood has been organized in that country forever as an opposition that was largely suppressed, but organized. And if you press this thing, push elections too quick, you can get very messy outcomes. And everyone looks at Iran in 1979 and goes, let's hope that's not what we're seeing unfold here.
Mark, is that what we might be seeing? Is there concern on the U.S. side?
Well, I would simply say I think that's a very valid point, and it also accounts for why you see in several of these countries very visible remnants of the old regime continuing to project their influence into the new era, whether it's Suleiman in Egypt or the vice president in Yemen. And in both cases, it's worth pointing out also that, I mean, Suleiman was a very trusted interlocutor for the United States during the upheaval when Mubarak's status and survival was coming under serious question. And there was even, I recall, during those critical days, the U.S. was sort of fastening some hope on Suleiman that he could help the country get through this period. So it'd be interesting to talk to the Egypt hands in the State Department and ask them their feelings about seeing this guy who they had such trust in, who then apparently disappeared entirely when Mubarak Mubarak step down, only to find out that he's really been quietly biding his time, keeping his office in the intelligence headquarters, and suddenly reemerges. I'm sure it inspires some mixed feelings on the part of the Americans.
I actually asked the State Department in the briefing about this, and they said they have no comment on candidates and, you know, Amr Sliman in particular. But I think also, if you look, this is going to be the decade of the Islamists. I mean, the liberal parties and the seculars has failed miserably in appealing to the masses. Yes, the Muslim Brotherhood have been waiting for 84 years to take power, and they have been very well organized. And it's true, they had the mosque to organize, but also they're really able to reach the common person in the street. The liberal parties, sometimes they live in the ivory towers, and they cannot make that connection with people in the street. So yes, they win majority votes because people vote for them. And also, most of the people who vote for them comes from the very poor suburb and neighborhood, and also there is money and there is organization. This guy, by the way, I just wanted to talk about him, who is the Salafist, which is an ultra-conservative party in Egypt called An-Nur. This guy, Hazem Abu Ismail, whose mother apparently is Egyptian citizen, is American citizen.
He became an American citizen.
Now they're saying if he can prove she has dual nationality, then it's okay, etc. But apparently he's like a pop star in Egypt. He has this star charisma everywhere he goes. He trimmed his beard like a crescent, you know. He's very charismatic. People love him. And today, actually, I saw a statistic just before I came. It's almost his second after Amr Musa in his chances of winning if he's not disqualified. But the Muslim Brotherhood, I think this is worth noting, they came to Washington last week, and they come in on this offensive charm to show that, no, it's not just... And I asked them this question actually at the Carnegie conference, and I said to them that the Islamists seems only to understand election from the process of democracy. How can you assure us that you're going to respect women's rights and minority rights, and you talk about building of constitution and it's going to be inclusive? And they said, and they're very well spoken, they speak English and French, they're clean shaven, they really appear to the West, and they met with officials at the State Department and in the White House, and also did the tour in the universities and everywhere in the United States to show that you can do business with them. He said to me that we did not fight against dictatorship to be replaced with dictatorship. But I still have my own doubts. We will see, because power is seductive, and once they are in power, they act differently than when they are out of power.
James.
The Muslim Brotherhood is in a state of transition, so we don't know what it's going to turn out. But here are some concerns. It wasn't the Muslim Brotherhood who took to the streets that really caused Mubarak to go. It was the liberals and the secularists and the people who were crying for democracy. And they were late to that game. Now they're taking advantage of their organizational skill, like they should in any democracy. The problem with Islamists is that they don't believe a separation of church and state. They believe that in theocracy. It's written in Sharia law, and they don't believe that there is an elected official that can rule over a theocratic. So the concern is you have a democratic election that elects, Islamists, and that's the last election you get.
Let's go to Danny. He's calling us from Jacksonville, Florida. Danny, you've been holding on. Thanks for being patient.
Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I actually have more of comment than questions. I just heard that this program is about international roundup, and I just feel that there is some area of the world that you guys are ignoring. For example, sub-Saharan Africa, they have a lot of problems right now, especially in South Sudan and Sudan and Mali and now Guinea-Bissau. But I wonder why the Western media, including the NPR, they do all this while there's actually trouble in sub-Saharan Africa. And I don't want to see, you know, another Rwanda on 2000s. Thanks, and I'll take my call over there.
All right, Danny, thanks so much for your call. You know, I'll just say two things. One is that... We do have issues of Africa on the international news roundup some weeks, not every week. This week we actually talked, the producers talked about whether we should have the issue in Mali and also the issue of Sudan and South Sudan on this week's roundup. It was the last topic we took off because we feel like we can't do the entire world every week. But it is true that we pay more attention to places where U.S. strategic interests seem to be more deeply involved.
I think it's a very fair criticism of the American media and the media in general. Sub-Saharan Africa does get ignored. And it is because, well, there's no oil there, and there really is no overriding strategic interest. Having said that, the administration and the previous administration worked very hard to find a solution to the Sudan civil war. That led to a referendum, and the South Sudan succeeded within the last year, I think it is. And now they're fighting, Sudan and South Sudan are fighting over oil fields. And so that problem has not been totally solved, and it's a good point. We should keep our eye on it.
Danny, we appreciate your call.
Nadia. No, I mean, I agree. I spent actually 10 years as a reporter in Africa, and it's hard even for our audience to give them stories that come in from Africa because, you know, generally people are just interested, politics is local or if it has an impact on their life, etc. But I agree, this is a very valid point that we should talk more about it.
Here's an emailer who wants to talk more about North Korea. He asks, will hardline factions make a move to take over key high positions in that regime as a result of the failure of the rocket launch?
I guess I'd answer by saying I'm not sure how you distinguish between hardline and softline when you're talking about North Korea. I mean, there really only seems to be one line. It is absolutely valid to say that there are some competing factions. And those might involve people close to the Kim family on the one hand and military commanders on the other hand. it's hard to know this right now. The U.S. And other foreign intelligence has struggled to make sense of the North Korean succession. Some people have said that Kim Jong-un has consolidated his power and in visible ways with the titles he keeps getting anointed with and in a real way in terms of his ability to project his power much more quickly than people expected. But again, do we really know that? No, we surmise that. And an event like this may actually show a level of insecurity on his part. Maybe he felt obliged to hold this week of events and festivities and the satellite launch because he felt the need to present himself as a leader in a more dramatic way.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850. Let's go to Rick. He's calling us from St. Louis. Rick, hi, you're on The Diane Rehm Show.
Hi, thank you. Speaking of things that we're not talking about, China, which is probably the most important international relationship, this story about Bo Jilai, which has been going on for quite a while and kind of underreported here. There are people in the intelligence community who believe this is a bigger deal than Tiananmen Square as far as the effect on the internal Chinese government, which, of course, then affects the rest of the world. Bo Jilai was head of the or was one of the leaders of the newer Maoist movement, and which is a real problem inside the Chinese party. I thought if any of you could comment on that, I'd like to hear what you have to say.
You know, Rick, I agree. I love this story. It is so interesting. I can't read enough about it. Mark, do you think, as Rick suggests, that it is actually something that tells us that things are changing in China?
First of all, I want to point out that we did have this one on our list. And in fact, we were saving it for the grand finale. So I think we all agree that this is one of those stories that, in addition to being sensational on its face, says something profound about China. And I think the point you make about his identification with the new Maoist movement is critical, and it probably explains why the communist leadership have been so aggressive and in some ways public about the way that they have gone after Bo Jilai and his wife and laid out a list of or are in the process of laying out a list of charges against them. I think sending a message to other people in positions of power, people that might be sympathetic to him, that they're not going to get any further with this. And also because I think they're worried that it exposes a web of corruption and nepotism and abuse of power that's true not only of Bo Jilai and his family, but of other senior leaders and members of the Politburo. So all of this happens against the backdrop of a leadership transition. And Rick, since you obviously know a lot about China, the level of paranoia that accompanies any leadership transition in China is extreme. And this one had appeared to be going relatively smoothly with Xi Jinping, the vice president, easing into the roles of Hu Jintao. But to have an event like this blow up in the middle of that raises all kinds of questions about stability. So I think we're heading into this very fascinating period, and it'll be interesting to see how the leadership navigates through all the landmines that this is likely to set off.
What would have been the traditional way, James, for China to handle a situation like this one?
I haven't seen a situation like this one before in China, but it would have handled it in secret. I mean, that's the sort of the catch, the mantra of the Chinese is don't show how, you know, what goes on behind the magic screen, because they want you to think this is all inevitable. And what we're finding out in this really fascinating window is it's not inevitable. There's power struggles going on here. I think, the point made is exactly right, that this guy, did have some sort of Maoist tendencies. He had this pageantry where people sang the old revolutionary songs, and seemed to suggest that he wanted to reverse the course a little bit and go back to the old Cultural Revolution days. And I think, ideologically, that's just not a big sell anymore in China, which is, had this fantastic growth rate because of its, marrying capitalism to this sort of quasi-communism. So, it's a fascinating look. What's really fundamentally different is we're getting to kind of see behind the curtain.
Politics, money, even a murder, the alleged murder, right, anyway, of a British businessman.
That's Nadia. Right. And just before that, I wanted to add that the former U.S. ambassador to China and former presidential candidate John Huntsman said actually this is a cutthroat politics in China more than ideological struggle. And yes, it has all the elements of a good soap opera. So he has the wife, the glamorous wife, who has a British businessman, and he was involved in the murder and poison, and a red Ferrari of Hassan, who's studying in Harvard. It's just a bit bizarre.
And who says international news can't be fascinating? I want to thank our panel for being with us. Nadia Bilbassi, James Kitfield, Mark Landler, thanks for joining us on The Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Susan.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back on Monday. Thanks for listening.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and